Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America?
Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 10. Really looking forward to this installment of the program because I met our guest tonight up at Portland at the International Cryptozoology Conference. And he was the man of the hour, I guess you could say. He's the 2017 Golden Yeti Award winner for Cryptozoologist of the Year, in part for his amazing films, these amazing documentaries that he's been making for the last few years, and he's churning out a ton of stuff, and it's tremendous. I kind of like have checked out, I guess you could say, in a sense, from like the paranormal media, so I think that's probably why I was kind of out of the loop, but as I saw these movies, I've seen a couple of them now, and they're absolutely fantastic, folks. They are absolutely really, really well made and awesome, and I'm going to talk more about how great they are in a moment, but I want to introduce them to the audience here. The 2017 Golden Yeti winner, Seth Breedlove of Small Town Monsters. Welcome to BOA Audio, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Tim, and I kind of have adopted the name Golden Yeti. So you can just straight up call me. You don't even need to say Golden Yeti winner. You can just say he is the Golden Yeti.
And
I think people will understand immediately that I am, that is who I am.
Yeah.
That's my persona.
Yeah, it's like the King of the Ring.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I thought.
For wrestling fans, yeah. Well, I got to say, dude, because he's got a new, he's right here. Seth's got a new movie coming out, October 20th. Where can folks get it? Let me get the name. It's Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, right? Invasion on Chestnut Ridge.
Yeah, it comes out October 20th, and it'll be available on Amazon and Vimeo On Demand, and through DVDs are available through our website.
Nice, nice. And Seth was kind enough to send me a screener copy, and I actually literally just finished it like 20 minutes ago because thankfully I knew how long it was, so I timed it out to finish right before the interview. And I got to tell you, man, this is an awesome movie. And I grew up on sort of like the Unsolved Mysteries era, and I've seen just tons of these types of films. But this one was like, and the big complaint or the big thing we say on the show a lot about movies and stuff about the paranormal is it's like, guys, you know, it's not made for us. It's made for, like, people who don't know anything about this stuff. But I can honestly say, as one of us, I thought it was awesome. I thought this movie went, like, way beyond any paranormal movies do. It's excellent, man. It really is. And it covers so many different parts of this Chestnut Ridge area of Pennsylvania. I misspoke in the preview of the show where I said it was about the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Witness. There's tons more in there. It's like there's so much stuff that happened in the Chestnut Ridge area, and you just pack it all in. So it's like you can really tell watching this movie that it was made by someone who knows the paranormal for people who know the paranormal, and that's really the highest compliment I can give when it comes to these kinds of movies, because so often it's like just cookie cutter stuff. This was like gourmet cookies here, man. This was really good stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. It's cool to hear you geek out on it like that. Cause like it is very much a buffet for people like us. Like, it's this endless collection, or seemingly endless collection, of really bizarre stories, each kind of getting weirder and weirder as you go on. And I think what's really strange, though, about the movie, you said there's, you know, we packed all this stuff in, and the strangest thing about the Chestnut Ridge is I feel like we barely scratched the surface of the amount of bizarre tales we could have told with this movie. I mean, it really is like, it's as much as is in there. I still, you know, there's endless amounts of tales of weird encounters with the unknown that we could have gotten into. And we were even, I was even cutting, I got to the point where I was cutting some stuff out of the movie, 'cause I was like, this is too weird. Like, this is so weird that I think anyone not totally involved in the paranormal will tune out at this point. There was at one time a line in the narration about giant iridescent caterpillars, and I was like, okay, that probably is going to need to come out. And it was that type of a story where it got so bizarre. I was like, this is probably pushing it even for us. So, but we had an absolute blast with the telling of this story. And I remember during the actual filming of the movie, the most common question I was getting from my crew was, how are you tying this all together? Because you got to think, like, we were shooting all these disparate witnesses and researchers kind of back to back, but all their stories, aside from where they take place, they don't have any connection to each other.
Right.
So for the crew, and even for myself, we were honestly as lost as anyone else would have been, because there was a game plan in place, but you're really, like, while you're shooting all this, you're like, man, this is so bizarre. I'm not sure how well all of this is going to come together.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. Well, because, I live near the Bridgewater Triangle, and so it's kind of like that's our window zone. I didn't realize Chestnut Ridge was so rich with stuff, but it was, you know, it was amazing. Like I said, because I confess, I judge a book by its cover. So I saw the cover of the movie, and I'm like, oh, it's about that UFO flap. That's awesome. And then I sat down and watched the movie, and I was like, afterwards, I was like, whoa. I'm blown away. There was way more, you know, there was just so much in there that, you know, it spawns like Kecksburg, that wave that I was just talking about, some crazy, like, Men in Black stories. I probably want to explore that a little bit with you in a moment, but let's do the bio background so I can satisfy my OCD. So who is Seth Breedlove, and how did you get mixed up in all this? And tell us about the genesis and evolution of Small Town Monsters.
Yeah, I started out as a newspaper freelance reporter. And basically at some point during my time as a freelance reporter, I got interested in the paranormal and decided this was a subject I kind of wanted to explore. So I had originally gotten into sort of like newspaper journalism, archival, like historical archival research. Mm-hmm. And during my looking into that, I decided I was going to do this book called Small Town Monsters that would delve into like five or six rural monster cases from around the country. And I submitted a book proposal to I think probably five or six different publishers, and they all rejected it. And naturally, we decided the next course of action was to turn one of the cases into a documentary.
Nice. And that was and so which one was that? The Minerva one, right?
What? Did I lose you?
I'm sorry, I lost you there.
Okay.
So you turned that into a documentary. That was the Minerva one, right?
Yeah, so we went to Minerva, and that's solely because it was, like, super close to where we lived, where I lived at the time, and I had already done preliminary research on the case and stuff like that. So we delved into that story, and that was fairly successful for us in terms of, like, pushing us to continue doing more. So we did Beast of Whitehall, and then we followed that up with Boggy Creek Monster, and it's been a chaotic rumble across the country since Boggy Creek Monster, but it's, you know, the stories continue to grow, and what we're doing continues to grow. We're kind of adding projects that I'm not necessarily involved in outside of producing as well to the roster. So we're trying to be the paranormal sort of production company. I mean, that's my goal, is to be making the absolute best of the best when it comes to these type of stories, and telling them in a way that I always wanted to see these stories told.
So have you had a long interest in, like, how long have you been into this stuff?
I got into it with the John Keel book, The Mothman Prophecies, by way of the Mothman Prophecies movie, and then finding the book. So, like, that was kind of my introduction to all of this. And from there, I delved into Bigfoot reports and lake monster stories. And I was addicted to, like, that show Monster Quest when I was younger.
Yeah.
So stuff like that is, like, what introduced me to this. And then when I really, and this isn't like just me kissing your butt or whatever, but I told you in Portland, like, when I first started kind of researching this kind of stuff for myself, the shows that I listened to were Beyond the Edge with Eric Altman, who is in Invasion on Chestnut Ridge,
yep,
and Been All of America. Like, those were two of the big shows that I listened to when I was first getting into this. And that would have been, like, you know what, like, probably like 7-8 years ago. And so, like, believe it or not, like, your influence on me is there. It's a part of it's a part of my outlook on the subject and everything. And that is part of maybe why I approach things and approach the subject the way I do is because of, you know, listening to shows like yours when I was first getting into all of this. And probably it influenced my cynicism toward some of the community and stuff as well, because I know you share some of those same opinions. So yeah, there's no like long story here as far as like how long I've been into this. I've only been into this really for like 7 or 8 years, but my interest in the paranormal and the unusual probably started around like 2002, 2003. I would have been like 22 years old.
Nice. There you go. So yeah, we must be about the same age then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, man, thank you. I'm humbled to hear you put us over like that. I appreciate it. So, see, the perfect guest here for the final season. See what we've helped create, folks, in our own small, measly manner. I'm at a loss for words, man. But I'm really humbled to hear you say that. How? I guess this sort of stuck. We're gonna go right to the interview now. So what stuck out to me that I thought was interesting, and we'll kind of break the fourth wall a little bit, about the movie. And now, I've only seen the Mothman film and this one, so I haven't seen the earlier ones yet. I'll catch up. But there was a lot of UFO in this movie. Is this like sort of a departure for you guys, you know, as far as storytelling goes? Because the previous movies were more sort of about creatures, right?
Right. Well, I think the Mothman movie got pretty...
It does, yeah. I mean, there is some...
Yeah, it's nothing to this extent, but yeah, I guess this is, I think in a lot of ways this is a departure for us. It was like the UFO stuff is a departure for us, and then the really bizarre kind of creature and orb and you know, strange creature sightings and thunderbirds and all that definitely is outside of what we had done before. The first three movies are very like ground level, almost PBS style approaches to the subject of Bigfoot, and then, you know, with Mothman we started kind of pushing in a different direction, and then Invasion we tried to do something completely different from what we'd done before. Maybe not completely different, but we wanted to step outside of the formula, even as far as like how we explore the small town and the small town's history and the impact on the region and that kind of stuff. And I think some of that was that we were really pleased with how Mothman had turned out. It was the first time we had finished a movie and we all didn't look back and go, man, we could have done so much better. And Mothman was the first time where we felt like we had done our job with the movie. And obviously, you know, we see a lot of issues with it and things we could have fixed or done better, but at the end of the day, we felt like we had achieved our goal. And I did not want to do a story that was that again. I didn't want to jump into something that was, you know, had that kind of weight and gravity that the Mothman story has. So what we wanted to do was something that was more like a compilation or a series of vignettes of really cool or creepy creature and UFO encounter stories. So we did something very different storytelling wise from the other movies. And I think we succeeded largely through luck and obviously just, you know, just being able to work with the team and the guys that work on the movies. It's hard to fail when you've got Zach Palmisano shooting your movie and you've got Brandon Dalo scoring it and Chris Scalf doing his amazing animated sequences and Matt Harris and Brandon Scalf doing their illustrations. And the team that we've compiled and put together is really solid. We continue trying to grow with each project. And you know, I was just talking with Zach today about the team, and like the desire is there to like try to keep it small. Like,
yeah.
Like the team right now that works on these movies is fairly small. So we like working in these kind of almost confined, group. And,
like a band.
Yeah, it really is. And, yeah, it was a departure from other movies in a lot of ways. Even tonally, like the approach we took to it is much more like a, it's almost like a nod to, you mentioned Unsolved Mysteries, and that was
to cut you off, because you're going right to where I was about to say, is it's funny you mentioned Monster Quest, because I got a real Monster Quest vibe from the movie. I didn't really realize it, I think, till you mentioned it, but it was like, that's what that reminded me of, like, Monster Quest back when it was, like, really good, when it first started out, you know what I mean? Like, in the later years, it was kind of, like, reachy, but in the first season or two, it was like, holy shit, this show is amazing, where'd this come from? And that was kind of the same reaction I had when I was watching your movie. It was like, this is, like, really well done by somebody who knows what they're talking about. So, yeah, I sensed a Monster Quest vibe from the movie.
The biggest influence on me was, like, the VHS documentaries, paranormal documentaries that I saw when I was a kid. And so we really, I watched endless amounts of Unsolved Mysteries during the editing of this. In fact, I watched every single season of Unsolved Mysteries during the editing of this movie. And
yeah, it does have a cool like 80s vibe to it too. Yeah.
So we tried to kind of grab that like feel that you got when you were younger. These documentaries, like, I don't know if you remember watching Unsolved Mysteries as a kid, but like, so it wasn't just Robert Stack's voice, even though that was a huge part of it. There was just something about the general vibe of that show that creeps me out. And I wanted to grab whatever that was and try to get it into this movie. So I think I hope we succeeded with that at least.
I don't know if this will resonate with you, but what always, like, I think what kind of hooked me in a weird sort of way with Unsolved Mysteries was, and I don't know if people remember this, I think maybe it's like an obscure sort of memory, but like back when it first came out, it wasn't a TV show, it was like a special, and it would only be on like once every three times a year, like during sweeps or something, I assume, for like the first couple of years. So it was like an event almost. And I really wasn't even into the paranormal per se, but it was like you'd see the commercials and you'd be like, oh, that shows those crazy stories is going to be back on, you know? Yeah. And then obviously it must have been so popular they made it into a TV show, but it was like that always – I think just like it was like forbidden. It was like this like rare – thing that, you know, it was this weird sort of thing that, and then, you know, then they made it a TV show and it was like, holy shit. But originally, yeah, it was this weird thing to it.
When it would come on at my grandma's house, because we didn't have TV at my parents' house, but when I was staying at my grandma's house, if Unsolved Mysteries came on, the second that theme song came on, I left the room.
Yeah.
Like, I was always terrified of that theme song and just the entire general mood of the show used to creep me out.
I think, too, because there was always, like, somebody that died or disappeared. Like, there was always one story with it was fantastic paranormal stories mixed with, like, horrifyingly frightening, like, woman who's kidnapped and kept in a cage for, like, 10 years. And
totally. Oh, and, like while going through all these seasons of it recently, I was watching one of these episodes where they really were doing a deep dive on, like, Roswell or something. And then all of a sudden – there's this mixed in with that. There's this story about this serial killer who is killing women along Highway 71, which is like right down the road from where I live now. I was like, there is no way this is like, it was taking place within probably 10 miles of where I live currently. And that was super unsettling because I'd never heard about this, but apparently there was this like serial killer who was a truck driver and was murdering women and leaving their bodies along the highway. That's like 10 minutes from my house.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's what they were showing with the Roswell stuff. And then it would be like, an old lady died in Pittsburgh and had $1 million in gold bars under her bed. No one knows how or why. And it was like, what?
Yeah. We should have mixed some of those types of stories into Invasion on Chestnut Ridge just to throw people off.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe you should, if you ever like go into the fictional route, I'd love to do a parody of a paranormal show. I think that would be great. And then you could do that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that would be fun. Oh, man. So, yeah, so the movie's coming out October 20th, and people can get it pretty much all over the place, right?
Yeah, and it'll be widely distributed later this year by Terror Films, so it'll be available on, like, iTunes and Google Play and all that stuff. But the biggest avenues you can get it when it first comes out are Amazon and Vimeo and DVD through the website. And we always try to put extra content on the DVD, so there's, like, a behind-the-scenes making of, which is kind of cool because, like, the movie was such a I hate to use the word rushed, but it was really rushed. Like, we shot the movie. We shot the movie in 2.5 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it was shot in 2.5 days, partially because Brandon, who's one of the, like, vital pieces of the crew, he was moving out to Los Angeles, like, a week after we finished filming. So we had to get it done. And I had just had my baby. We just had our baby boy. He was only, I think, 3 weeks old when I had to go to PA to film this. So we were on a real time crunch with this movie. So the entire thing was basically shot in 2.5 days, minus some of the recreation scenes. Like the Mystery Man sequence I shot here in Ohio, actually at my sister's house. And a couple of the recreations were shot, you know, after the fact. But there was one day where we went back to shoot the Kecksburg Festival that's in the movie at the very end.
Right.
But other than that, yeah, it was like a 2.5 day shoot. And we did, I think, 8 or 9 interviews and all of our B-roll in that span of time.
Wow. Holy shit. Well, it's been long days.
Yeah, 14. Usually we work about 14 hours. Like when we filmed Boggy Creek Monster down in southern Arkansas, the entire movie was shot in 5 days, and we were working 14 to 16 hours a day.
That makes sense, yeah. I mean, you want to get as much shit as you can. You want to get as much material as you can. I mean, you interviewed a ton of people in the movie, so it's pretty remarkable to hear it was done in like 2 days. Now, what made you choose? Let me back up because it's an interesting sort of like difference. I like it though because it must have been a challenge to do the Mothman movie in a sense, just because like it's such an iconic case and there's been, I think I've seen like 2 or 3 documentaries on Mothman at least.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I'm sure that, I mean, kudos to you for having the bravery to take that on. Like, what were you thinking going into that, like how to take a different spin on the Mothman? Because I guess why I said back up, because it was like, because then you've pivoted to like a pretty obscure area, which is Chestnut Ridge. So it's an interesting, like you didn't jump from Mothman to, I don't know what the, you know, I can't think of an equivalent to Mothman, but.
Yeah, like Jersey Devil or something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny the way you said that too. You were like, "What were you thinking?" And that's what, like, honestly, that's my biggest reservation with Mothman was the fact that I really felt like it'd been done to death. And Brandon and I, when we were picking the movie to make after Boggy Creek Monster, that was what I kept saying to him. It's like he really wanted to do Mothman, and I just kept saying, I do not know how we're going to approach this and tell the story in a way that hasn't been done before. And you know, I guess what happened with me is I did sit down and watch a bunch of those documentaries, and it just struck me that there was no really, I want to say this without insulting some of the filmmakers, because I know some of the guys that made some of those other movies, and I really do enjoy two of those Mothman documentaries. I think are actually really good, but
no, I didn't say they were bad. I just said
right.
I've had people who made a Mothman doc. I just mean it's like, I mean, yeah. I haven't had that many guests, but you're the second Mothman documentarian I've had, so that's how you know, how prolific it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And I think my decision was just let's try to tell it in like a really chronological, straightforward fashion where we can lay out for people that might not know much about the Mothman story how all this took place simultaneously, or not simultaneously, but over the course of this like 13-month span, and leave out all the kind of like theories about what Mothman might be and how all these things might be tied together by this conspiracy or that conspiracy, and just simply put out there what we know as far as eyewitness reports and let the audience make up their mind. And then obviously the bridge was the main factor for me in wanting to make the movie. I had yet to see a movie about the Mothman where they hadn't tried to make the bridge collapse seem like just another part of the Mothman story, or like it had, you know, some major impact, or not major impact, but like somehow it was caused by the Mothman or so my interest was much more like, let's show how much the town was impacted by the bridge collapse. And people can make up their own minds regarding all of this, how the Mothman is connected to the bridge collapse, if it's connected. I personally don't think it is, but like, let's just put everything out there on the table and let people make up their own minds about the whole thing. So, and I really am, that's why I'm so proud of the way that movie came out. I really think the chronological approach to it worked so well. And it's really, I think, surprising for people who don't know a lot about the Mothman to sit down and watch that movie, because you start to see that, oh man, it was like this event happened and then it led to this, and then this led to this, and this led to this, until it all is accelerating towards something, and then the bridge collapse happens, and then you realize, okay, it, you know, maybe everything was moving toward this one moment. Now, whether those events are connected, you know, the bridge collapse, I have no idea, but the whole thing is all about momentum in that movie. That movie is all about kind of a forward, you know, motion towards that moment, that defining moment when the Silver Bridge collapsed and 46 people lost their lives and the town was pretty much changed forever by it. So the fear was there right up until the last day of editing. I mean, as far as like, is this different enough from the other movies out there? And we were really, I was really concerned about that all the way through post-production. Is this different from the other movies that are out there? Is this worthwhile? And I think we've come to find that people really do respond to it, whether they've seen the other documentaries, whether they're diehard Mothman historians, or whether they're a complete novice and know nothing about that story. It seems like people are really responding to that movie. So for us, that's really cool.
Yeah. Well, I can say, like I said, it was very different from a lot of the other movies I've seen, because you mixed in a lot of stuff, a lot like kind of like the Chestnut Ridge film. You do mix in outside stuff that, like, Injured Cold is in the movie, and it's, I was, you know, I remember sitting there in Portland watching the movie, and I was like, you know, almost, I wouldn't say like a gasp, but like taken aback in a way where I was like, oh, wow, this is a different direction that this movie's going now. Yeah. You know, for a Mothman movie, like, I don't think I've ever seen Injured Cold weaved into the story before, and it's like, I was only really vaguely familiar with it, so, you know, I ended up looking more into the Injured Cold story, but it was like, it gave the movie a whole different like flavor to it, and I hadn't really realized what you had done in the movie until you mentioned it. But yeah, there's no sort of like, oh, is it this? Could it have been that? They think it might have been this or whatever. There really was like no hand holding in the movie, and I like that a lot, because normally, you know, that's exactly, because when you've been in this field for so long and looked at this stuff for so long, it's like that's the, like I said before, it's like, oh, they don't make shows for people like us, folks. Like, this movie is geared for folks like us who, we already are, a lot of that superfluous junk isn't in the movie, you know? We already know the theories. We already have heard the stuff. And so Seth has the room to put in more awesome interviews and more interesting angles to the story. So kudos, man.
Yeah, and I don't know that stops at simply like people that are super into the paranormal or Bigfoot or whatever. I think a general audience doesn't necessarily want to be told what crazy theory to lean toward. I always think of my wife's grandpa when I'm making these movies, weirdly enough, because he like has a passing interest in these subjects. But if you put on like one of these crazy documentaries on TV, he usually just shrugs it off or laughs it off, you know?
Yeah.
But if he sits, he'll sit down and like watch like Survivor Man Bigfoot or something like that. And I remember noticing his everything about his response to that versus his response to like mountain monsters or finding Bigfoot. It was just eye opening for me that here's this guy who's an older man who's got a passing interest in these subjects, but you wouldn't know it unless you had a conversation with him. But when I make these movies, I really try to focus on people like him as much as people like you and me, because you know, like he's interested, but he doesn't want to be talked down to or you know, and he's not. He does not want to buy into, you know, whatever crazy theory you want to throw at him. You know, let him reach his conclusions on his own.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because nobody wants, because half the time, if you're being told like 10 theories on what it means, that's like 9 of them aren't even, you know, if one of them's right, the other 9 are wrong. So like, who cares? You know, it's sort
right.
of like a waste of time. You know,
right.
It's like
yeah.
you want to just make up your own mind. Unless somebody, unless you do a whole movie on just the one theory, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, only.
Yeah, and we like delved into briefly, I think, in the movie, like some of the, you know, I think we mentioned like that people thought it might have been a sandhill crane, and we mentioned that the pollution aspect, you know, the fact that some people thought it might have been some sort of like mutated bird or something like that. But,
right, right.
You know, I mean, it's pretty obvious that you know, like Lawrence Gray thinks it was the devil, and this guy thinks it was some sort of alien, and this guy thinks it's an angel. You know, like, and at the end of the day, it's all going to be up to the audience to make up their mind one way or the other, anyway. So.
Yeah.
Don't
yeah.
talk down to people is our, I think one of our number one goals is to try to make an intelligently, you know, intelligent approach to these stories.
Yeah. Well, it's like, there's a sense of wonder, but there's not sort of like a sensationalism of the wonderment, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, hey, isn't this interesting stuff? And it's not like, hey, come inside. And you know, so yeah, there's a good vibe to it.
Yeah.
Now, how did you pivot to Chestnut Ridge then? Were you like, all right, I'm not doing Jersey Devil guys. I'm not doing the Patterson Gimlin film or whatever. You know, what made you jump to the Chestnut Ridge?
So it was originally going to be a short film, which I say very often, by the way, if you've heard any me talk about any of these movies, I very often say that what I'm working on now is going to be a short film. And typically they do not turn out to be a short film, which was the case with Minerva Monster or with Invasion of Chestnut Ridge and Minerva Monster actually. But Invasion was originally going to be this little like 35-minute movie, mostly focused on Kecksburg and the Fayette County UFO Bigfoot flap.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was during the actual lead up to the movie when I started scheduling interviews, I remember Stan being like, do you want, you know, here's a list of people we could talk to. Who do you want me to really go out and see if they want to talk to you? And I remember seeing Aaron Shakti's name on the list, and Aaron was the Thunderbird witness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, I would love to talk to a guy about Thunderbirds. So I mean, that's pretty, it honestly just kind of turned into the fact that these were stories that I was fascinated with on a personal level. So let's try to squeeze it all in. So as far as like how this became the movie after Mothman, this was originally, this was always part of our 2017 plan. And I never thought of Mothman as like the next hot thing. Like this is going to be the movie that really changes our lives. So let's, what are we going to do in response to that? It was never
right.
like that. It was like, what are we going to do, you know, when we're done with this story? And then of course, Mothman came out and it did change our lives because it hit big and hit way bigger than we were expecting it to. And, it kind of did change the game. So it's funny now, 'cause like my idea with Invasion was like, let's do something totally different, like totally different from Mothman, something that's fun and scary and creepy and a collection of stories. And so that's how we got to that place. Now, the other reason is that I really like Stan Gordon, and I like listening to interviews with Stan and hearing him tell these incredibly bizarre stories. And so part of it was also just my own interest in making something where Stan would be a part of it and be able to kind of on camera tell about his decades long look into the subject. I mean, Stan's interview is 3 hours long.
Oh, wow.
And he's in the movie, you know, probably on camera for like 15 minutes, maybe. I don't know how long his total camera time is, but like we literally have like hours of Stan telling crazy stories. So when I get to the Case Files episodes for those Invasion on Chestnut Ridge episodes that we'll have for Stan, it's going to be a lot of fun because there's a lot of really weird stuff we didn't get to.
Yeah, he's an unsung hero. We had him on the show before. If I can find the space, I should get him back on for season 10 because he has some crazy stories, and he's been doing it. In a way, it's funny, like you were saying about what's the thread of the movie. And you know, I was thinking it's like at the beginning in the Kecksburg thing, I think he says he was like 16 years old and he was mixed up in that. And it's like he's kind of the thread of the movie in a way because he was involved in a lot of these cases mentioned.
He's the main. If we have a quote-unquote main character, it's definitely Stan. I mean, the movie begins and ends with him, and he's been researching since 1959. I think the other, like, thread of the movie is that the fact that these are all researchers. There's only one guy in the movie, John, that isn't a researcher. John was, like, the Kecksburg witness. Everyone else in the movie is, like, actively out there trying to figure out, you know, what's going on the ridge. So I think that's kind of interesting, especially compared to our other movies, because most our other movies are almost entirely comprised of like witnesses and then locals, whereas Invasion is almost entirely people who investigate the unknown, who've had strange experiences. And in some cases, like in Barry Clark's, in the case of Barry Clark, it had a, you know, a terrible impact on his life.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because that was one character or individual who stood out in the movie to me, because he had I think it was a UFO encounter from, I can recall, and a vivid UFO encounter, and he was like, I'm out, I'm not doing this anymore, I don't want anything to do with this paranormal stuff. And it's like, A, you rarely hear of any of these researchers. That's different in a sense from the movie, too, because, like, you know, Stan Friedman doesn't have, like, a vivid UFO sighting. Like, most of the people I know have never really had something completely life-altering or even that, like, remarkable as far as paranormal goes. So it's cool that a lot of these guys have. But with him, it was too much. It was like, you know, I think I've only heard of that happening a couple of times. And you know, something one of them may have been him. Like, and I may not have made the connection of the name, but... But it was very, like, be careful what you wish for kind of, like, thing to it. So talk about this guy and his sort of journey, in a sense.
Yeah, Barry is like, my favorite character, quote-unquote character, in the movie. And he's someone that I got to know a little bit off-camera and talk to. And the actual impact of what has happened to him isn't as apparent on camera in this movie as it was in real life, which obviously is going to happen. But Barry was one of Stan's right-hand guys. Like, he was always helping Stan on investigations. He was a vital part of the research group. He investigated a lot of cases, particularly at one location known as the Bell Farm. It's not actually called the Bell Farm. That's like a pseudonym they gave to the location. But the Bell Farm was this location on the ridge where lots of unusual activity was taking place, not just UFOs, but Bigfoot encounters and black cat sightings and all kind of weird stuff. And Barry had a strange incident occur there where something had screamed at him, like a Bigfoot type creature had screamed at him, or he thought it was a Bigfoot type creature. And a few weeks after that, he received a phone call from the Bell Farm people saying that they were seeing this strange light show up in the sky, like a star. a really bright star every night, right around, I think he says like right around 10 p.m. or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes out to the Bell Farm to investigate it one night, and they're watching the sky right around 10 p.m. And this, sure enough, this light shows up in the sky right at the, 10 o'clock. And they're watching the star, and it seems like it's getting brighter, and then it turns blood red. And when it turns blood red, all these little lights in the sky appear and start moving toward the blood, now blood red light in the sky. And the way he puts it is like bees going to a beehive.
Yeah, and the animation was awesome there. Hats off to your animation guy, because I read so many UFO books, and it's obvious. I mean, it's an obvious point, but at the same time, it bears mentioning. It's like, but when you see it, when you hear the witness describing it, and you see it unfold on the screen, it's way more powerful than reading it in the book. It's like, and the animation, he like bees to the hive, and that's what these little lights are. It's amazing.
Yeah, and as they're watching all these lights go into the big light, and then the big light turns silver again and then starts getting brighter, and they realize the light was actually coming down, like it was descending toward them. And I know at the time they were outside, and it was Barry and this guy and his wife, and the wife ran and jumped in the car. She was terrified. And Barry and the other guy continued watching it, and it continued coming lower, and they eventually got freaked out, jumped in the car, and they drove off. After that, Barry started suffering some bizarre side effects. Basically, what he thinks may have happened is that he might have suffered some sort of alien abduction scenario. He was driving late one night and had an incident of missing time. And that was followed up by some really strange occurrences around his house. The unfortunate side of it, and really what drove him to kind of leave paranormal research in general, was that it started seeming to rub off on his grandson, who was only about 8 years old at the time. And his grandson would tell them about these men who would come through a hole in his ceiling. There's some really disturbing aspects to this case that Barry left out of his on-camera interview. He actually made us turn the camera off and confided some things to us that left us really disturbed. Jesus. Unfortunately, it's not going to be in the movie.
Extra.
It's one of those things, like I really wish in a way it would have been in the movie, because I think it would have been extremely apparent to people why this guy got out of research, maybe more so than it is, within the film now. But unfortunately, he had to shut the cameras off and didn't want it on camera. So he had some really disturbing things happen to him. And he actually, the strange thing is, like, Barry had files. I guess he was very studious in like keeping files of all the cases he'd investigated, with sketches and plaster casts and all that kind of stuff. He got rid of all of it. In fact, some of it he burned.
Oh, Jesus, no.
From what he told. Yeah, so like when he got out, he got out. Like, he didn't want anything to do with it. And as the movie goes on, it kind of becomes apparent he's vaguely considering getting back into it. It's almost like, and we pointed toward that through the narration in the movie, how like these investigators that are on the ridge, it's almost like they're driven, to continue going out, doing what they're doing. Cause even Barry is like, he's starting to feel that pull of like wanting to go out. And he talked to us about that, how, and I can't remember right now if it's in the movie, but he talked about, he wonders if he went back out and investigated if bad things would start to happen again. And so that's what keeps him from doing it. But he's getting to the point where he's considering going back out again.
Interesting.
And he's, he's a lot older than he was in the 70s. But that curiosity, that, the way Mark Maskey wrote the narration, is that human curiosity keeps getting the better of him.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's in the movie, so it's, it's clearly he's, like, not completely divorced from the subject, in a sense, you know what I mean? Because there are some,
yeah.
I mean, I know there are some people that, like, are like, I'm out, and then if you try and contact them, they're like, contact me again, I'm calling the cops. It's like,
right.
What?
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, it was really interesting. And I mentioned the injured cold thing earlier. Is this like a conscious decision on your part, I guess, in a sense? And because I don't want to like make you give away too much of the movie. So it's but it's like you have the injured cold incident, let's say, in the Mothman movie, and then you also have like these really crazy Men in Black type stories in the Chestnut Ridge movie, which I loved. Like those were awesome. So it must like click with me too. But is there something about like sort of this mysterious human element, you know, quote unquote, like that sort of recurs in these movies, at least these last two films?
I think it's just an aspect of like the idea of high strangeness in general, that those seem to be a part of the stories, because like with Mothman, you cannot get away from like the Men in Black connection.
Right.
Especially if you're into Kiel stuff. And then with Stan's work, the more I read Silent Invasion and the further I got into Silent Invasion, the more stories he starts, you know, popping in there about these mysterious figures. And there does seem to be a difference between, you know, Stan's Men in Black and John Keel's Men in Black. It seems like Stan's Men in Black are more like shadowy government agents, whereas John Keel gets into the really bizarre, you know, like Nick Redfern style Men in Black, where they almost seem like, you know, aliens or something like that. But this is the Men in Black in the Invasion really seem, you know, like shadowy government agents. It's just why they're there, what their purpose is, you know, all the mysteries of connected with like the Men in Black subject in general that I love so much are here. And maybe it's because I'm in personally into that idea, the Men in Black idea and the Men in Black subject, that I included that as heavily as we did in the movie, because, you know, there were things that we actually had to leave out of Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, you know, like bizarre people saw have been seeing like Russian military on the Chestnut Ridge for decades, like Russian
what?
Military doing training exercises and stuff. Yeah.
Weird.
And that was left out of the movie, and there's all kinds of stuff left out of the movie, but then there's heavily, you know, the Men in Black element. But I think the reason it's so prevalent in our film is because it ties into that, the 1973-74 flap of UFO Bigfoot sightings. You know, the MIB starts showing up right around that same time, and they seem to be intrinsically tied to those stories, especially Superior, you know, the Superior sightings that took place. And we left out, you know, MIB stories that are fantastic. There's a couple of them that I really enjoyed that didn't make it into the film, but like, yeah, I think that might be more my interest in Men in Black than necessarily a story component that had to be in place there. It might have just been me wanting to explore that for myself.
Well, it takes it to a different level, which I really like a lot. Like I said, it with both the Injured Cold and the Men in Black aspect with the Mothman movie and this movie, like I said, it kind of – I felt like it added an element to the movie that you don't see very often, and as someone who is really intrigued by that kind of stuff, I was like, whoa, this is amazing. Now, like I said, I don't want to, like, people got to see this movie, folks. It comes out October 20th. This Men in Black, I'll do a thumbnail quick version just to make my point. This dude shows up, he whips out a badge, he says he's with the government, he takes pictures of this Bigfoot print. This kid, little kid next to him, takes a picture on a Polaroid, and the guy like snatches it, and then he goes over to the Bigfoot print and like wipes it out with his foot. I can't believe these guys didn't kick his ass right there, but I guess they thought he was with the government, and they get all pissed off, and he runs to his car and takes off. And it's like, when you really look at that story, it's like you only have two options. Like, the government had some group, like an X-Files type group out there trying to look at this stuff, or the guy was just a crazy nutcase, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
You can't really go anywhere with the guy was a crazy nutcase idea, so we'll leave it at that. But the other aspect is like, wow, that's really interesting. Maybe there were people out there, you know, like the X-Files. Maybe there really was like a real-life X-Files. You know, they closed down Blue Book and Condon Report, closed it down and all that, and then they were like, well, what do we do with all this weird stuff that people are reporting?
Right. I mean, it does. It opens up like this whole pathway, this rabbit trail of like ideas or theories you can come up with on this story, because like Stan and Jack. Stan and Jack. Jack was the guy who actually lived in Superior Mobile Home Park. And Stan, they both say that the guy's car had government plates on it.
Yeah.
And not Pennsylvania. He had Ohio government plates on his car, which is unusual too, because he's in PA and you're not necessarily that close to the border there. You know, you're still like an hour away from Ohio.
Yeah, he'd have to be dispatched out there from where somewhere
right.
to send him.
Right, and it's just really unusual. And then when you get into like the guy that told Stan told Stan that he worked for the U.S. Department of what was it? The U.S. Department of Fish and Mammals Lab.
Yeah,
I mean, like some of this stuff is so weird, but it does seem that there genuinely was government interest in this, because even Stan was receiving questions from a congressman and met with assistance to this congressman, which we briefly mentioned in the movie. I mean, there really was some sort of government interest in what was going on along the ridge especially during the 70s. I don't know how far you can track those MIB stories after that, you know, like if it was an ongoing thing. I don't think it was, not to that extent anyway, but definitely during the 70s that was still going on. And then, you know, while we were making the film, we found out all that stuff about the theory is that there's this like Russian military involvement taking place along the ridge. Now that I wasn't aware of. I knew that people had seen possible like government activity along the ridge. They've seen like Black Hawk type helicopters.
What is the, I'm just confused. Like, what is the theory though? Like that the Russians have a secret base on the thing and the government doesn't know about it.
That's kind of what the theory seems to be, is that there's this like secret Russian facility or something built into the ridge, and there's these, you know, they're up there on the ridge performing training exercises. There is going to be, I keep mentioning Case Files, and that's just because I'm working on it right now, so it's like fresh in my mind, but there's going to be an episode of Case Files that'll hopefully delve into some of that, because we talked to Dwayne Pintoff a lot about that aspect of the story.
Well, you've mentioned it a couple times, so we should probably, you know, like I said, to satisfy my OCD. So what is Case Files, so people know what that is? Because we've been plugging the movies, but they're like, what is Case Files? So what is it?
Case Files is like the place where we'll be it's going to be on our YouTube channel and then Amazon Prime, so it should be entirely free. It's little like 7 to 8 minute long, possibly even longer, mini small town monsters movies, usually comprised of like cut interviews or things that didn't make it into the final film. You know, we conduct these long interviews and then the final movie is like an hour long, so stuff gets left on the floor, and a lot of it is great. So what we're doing is actually editing these into like little mini short films that'll delve deeper into some of the stories that are briefly touched on in our films. And you mentioned Injured Cold. The first episode is a two-parter all about Injured Cold, and we actually went and conducted an interview with Woody Derenberger's daughter, so we have all this kind of like side info on Injured and kind of the effect of Injured Cold on the lives of the Derenberger family. And we shot an interview with a Kecksburg witness that didn't make it into Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, so there's all kind of basically like side trails, rabbit trails from the regular Small Town Monster series that you'll be able to see weekly between November and February or March of 2018.
And those will be on YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube and our Amazon. There's going to be like, you'll actually be able to see it in a seasonal format on Amazon Prime as well.
Nice. Now, let me see what. So, what else are you. You probably don't. Well, talk about the couple of movies that you have cooking that you're helping out with or helping to produce. I know one's the Champ movie, right?
Yeah, I'm producing On the Trail of Champ, which is it's like this new idea I had because I wasn't busy enough. So I came up with this idea of doing these mini series through Small Town Monsters called On the Trail of, that would be a miniseries format and a deeper look into some of these stories that we love The Champ story is really fascinating because it's got decades long, you know, history, and it's got so many witnesses. And then also, like, something we always get asked is, like, why don't you guys include actual search footage, you know, for the monsters and stuff? So I wanted to find a way to kind of include. Yeah, people do that always. So it's like
weird.
That's where the real, like, Monster Quest influence is going to come out, I think.
Yeah.
Is, like, on the trailer.
I was just thinking of that one. Yeah, I was like, that sounds like more like Monster Quest. Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be like a probably a 6-episode miniseries. It's being directed by Alexander Petikov, who shot it over the summer, and then I'm producing it. But it'll be very much a Small Town Monsters project. We're still having, like, all the guys that kind of contribute art to Small Town Monsters are going to be a part of that, including Chris Scalf, who does those animated sequences. So you'll get to see Chris animating a champ, which I'm pretty excited about.
Nice.
Yeah, so that comes out probably next June, and we're going to premiere a few of those episodes at our Minerva Monster Day event that we do each year in Ohio. And then I am executive producing a documentary called Cryptozoologist that has Lauren Coleman and Lyle Blackburn, Linda Godfrey, Adam Davies, a whole bunch of people, and it looks incredible. But they just recently kind of got me on board that as well, and that'll be made in association with Small Town Monsters. So, and their Kickstarter for that just launched too. I should probably mention
it's called Cryptozoologist. Is it like sort of like a profile on these people?
It is the definitive documentary about the study of cryptozoology.
That sounds awesome.
If you got to check out the trailer, because the trailer for it is gorgeous.
And who's doing that?
And then, that is being made by a guy. It's produced by a guy named Matt Ralston and directed by a guy named Brad Abrahams. I don't know if you've seen, they did a short film called Swan Song for the Skunk Ape. It came out maybe like 2 years ago, and it's amazing. And then they just finished a documentary called Love and Saucers, or Love and Flying Saucers, I can't remember, that just premiered at Fantastic Fest. Which, just getting into Fantastic Fest is a pretty big deal. So, but it looks kind of comical. It looks very funny. It's beautifully shot. And everything those guys do is gold that I've seen so far.
Nice. Well, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
because I love all these people. They're all great people. I can only imagine you're kind of the same way, because you said how much you wanted to sort of feature Stan and stuff. It's like Lauren Coleman is just being able to, like, know Lauren and stuff is the coolest part of one of the coolest things that ever happened to me getting involved in this field. Like,
right. I just said that exact same thing to my wife tonight, because, like, it is my goal to make, you know, some sort of like profile piece on Lauren at some point. I don't know when I'm going to find the time, but I would love to do some sort of, like, documentary about his life.
Yeah, he's just an amazing, amazing guy. And, I feel lucky to, like, know him. And it's just weird to have grown up and, like, read all these books and stuff. And it's just crazy. He's the man.
Yeah. Yep.
What the hell was I going to ask you? I lost my train of thought. Well, we're at the top of the hour. We still got another hour to go. Let me ask you one of these questions that somebody sent in. Somebody sent in some weird-ass question that I was like, are you serious? Is this for real? But I'll ask it, and that way I can wait for my train of thought to pull back into the station. So let's see what this guy asked. Michael Reynolds. He wanted to know, can you ask him about his donkey? And also, please ask him about Area X.
His donkey.
He said, and I said, what? I said, are these real things? If I can remember, I'll ask, son. He says, haha, he used to have a donkey. Haven't heard him mention it in a while.
He's mistaking me for Sam Rich. My buddy Sam Rich has a donkey. I do not have a donkey, but as far as Area X is concerned, Area X is, so I'm a member of a Bigfoot group, like a Bigfoot research group, called the North American Wood Ape Conservancy. Kathy Strain is a member. Kathy and Bob Strain are members, and some really, like, solid, well-adjusted, non-crazy people. And they spend a large chunk of the year in this place in the Wachita Mountains in Oklahoma called Area X. That's what they call it. And they go in shifts, and they spend a lot of time trying to interact, or, you know, basically prove
Did I lose you? I lost you for a minute there.
Okay.
That was weird.
Am I
basically
back?
Yeah, you said basically prove, and then you cut out. Oh, weird.
Anyway, yeah, it's just this place where they go to try and essentially prove the existence. I don't have anything. I have nothing right now on
Apex or whatever.
Yeah, Area X.
I'm sorry that guy confused you for someone else. This is why I try not to take questions from the audience, because they're always like, ask about this, and I'm like, they don't know.
they don't know anything
about that.
It's cool. At least I knew exactly what he was talking about.
That's true. So yeah, we'll try and get an update on the donkey for you some other time, folks. Oh my God.
Tonight we will recreate D.B. Cooper's last flight and examine two other cases. In one, an $8 million collection of sports memorabilia has disappeared. Among the treasures was Babe Ruth's uniform. In the other, two teenage boys lay motionless in the path of an onrushing train. Their parents believe they were murdered.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Join me. You may be able to help solve the mystery.